You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Let's hear our reading from Isaiah this morning.
From the book of Isaiah, chapter 49, verses 8 through 10. Thus says the Lord, in a time of favor I have answered you. On a day of salvation I have helped you. I've kept you and given you as a covenant to the people, to establish the land, to apportion the desolate heritage, saying to the prisoners, come out. To those who are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed along the ways in all the bare heights and shall be their pasture. They will no longer hunger or thirst. Neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them down. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by the springs of water will guide them. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
And I'm also going to read from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25, verses 35 through 36. I was hungry, and you gave me food to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothes to wear. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. It's good to be with you. I love new experiences. Meeting cousins is going to be one of those new experiences that I'm really looking forward to later today. I could not have felt more welcome this weekend. Sharon Elrod was my host and really made me feel welcome. And David's family, I feel like family with them. We're like brothers from another mother and another father, by the way. But it's really been great to be here. I also, another new experience, I asked if he had a robe I could borrow, and he said, yes, I have one, and it's pretty long as well. This is the first experience I've ever had of putting on a robe that's been too long for me. So there must be giants in this church. It's also a joy to be with you on a rainy day in Fountain Hills. I was not expecting that, to be here on a rainy day in Fountain Hills. And I looked up to see how much rain you get in a year here, and it said 12 inches of rain per year. So far today, at least when I last looked, it's been raining the last few minutes, you've had 0.71 inches of rain today. So a pretty good amount of your yearly rainfall has occurred today. And my guess is that living in a desert, that rain is a welcome occurrence. So after the service, you can thank me for bringing this rain with me. Almost 1/12 of your yearly average. You may have read in my bio that I teach social and ecological ethics. In fact, the title of my professorship is the Wimberly Professor of Social and Ecological Ethics. And I teach at Oklahoma City University, which is one of our United Methodist universities, by the way, and I'm a United Methodist elder as well. And I teach environmental ethics as one of the main courses that I teach. And my teaching that course led me to be selected as the Oklahoma State Humanities Scholar on a project called the Waterways Project. And it's sponsored by the Smithsonian Institute as well as the Oklahoma Humanities Program. It's called the Museum on Main Street Program. And so over the next year and a half, there will be a traveling Smithsonian exhibit in 5 locations around the state of Oklahoma, and this exhibit will focus on the many complex ways that humans interact with water in the world, including the economic, political, and ecological challenges that we are currently facing in our world in our interactions with water. And on that note, I want you to know about, I think, a really exciting opportunity for you, and that is that the Arizona Humanities Program here is currently hosting this same Waterways exhibit, this traveling exhibit, and it's in multiple locations in the state of Arizona. And these exhibits are usually in places that do not normally have the opportunity for a Smithsonian-style exhibit. So they're usually in smaller communities. So I invite you to look at the Arizona Humanities website to see where the locations are here in your state. And I do hope that at some point between now and March 2020, which is how long these exhibits will be in your state, that you'll have an opportunity to visit one of those exhibits. Well, my work with this Waterways project has given me an opportunity to reflect on the importance of water in our lives and to reflect on the current set of challenges that we face when it comes to water in our local and in our regional context, but also in the world as a whole. And this is one of the reasons that David and I decided on the topic of water for this morning's service. We understand, and perhaps you understand more than most, we understand in an existential way that water is life, and that we are water. It only takes a few experiences of deprivation of water to realize that without water, not only are we unable to flourish, we are unable to survive. My first personal experience of that was walking down the Grand Canyon with my family at age 6. And I drank probably too much water on the first half of the leg down to the bottom of the canyon, and not enough water on the last half. And I remember being almost delirious and with dehydration at the end of that hike, stumbling my way into Phantom Ranch at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Now, that didn't keep me from going back. I actually hiked the Grand Canyon a total of 5 times, but I remember very clearly, that's a very clear early memory, of what it was like to feel deprived of water. So we know that we cannot survive without water. We also know through science that the majority of our very bodily being is composed of water. The average adult male in this room is 60% water. The average adult female in this room is 55% water. And our babies are like bundles of water. Our babies are 75% water, and children are around 65% water. We also know that 71% of our planet is covered in water, and this fact became very evident when NASA took that first amazing perspective-changing Earthrise photo while orbiting the moon on December 24, 1968, just over 50 years ago. We also know that only about 1% of the water on Earth is what we call fresh water, water that is usable by human beings and the many other forms of life that do not live in the oceans. Those of you who live here in the desert have a rather unique understanding of just how significant water is for life. You understand how difficult it would be, really how impossible it would be for large numbers of people to live in this desert without some way of making sure that a stable and sustainable amount of water is present. The indigenous people who lived in this area, and I got to learn more about this at one of the local museums yesterday, the indigenous people who lived in this area for centuries developed some amazing skills of engineering to create canals to bring water to a network of communities of life that were able to sustain agriculture. And today, you would not be living here if it were not possible to store and transport water to your communities. These technological feats, and they are technological feats, are to be celebrated. For without them, it would not be possible for us to be here with each other today. But in the midst of our many success stories, in terms of our being able to bring life-sustaining water to human communities, we're also aware of the many challenges that human communities around the world face when it comes to water. We have witnessed intense conflict when it comes to water, especially in the latter half of the 20th century up to the present day. The water wars of the 20th and 21st century have included a brutal civil war in Sudan. We also know that the extreme drought that was experienced in Syria exacerbated the tensions and the conditions that contributed to the civil war in Syria. There are numerous conflicts among tribal communities in various regions in Africa over water. In one case, the shores of a very large lake that is in both Ethiopia and in Kenya, the shores of that lake have been receding so quickly that the northern shores that used to be in Ethiopia are now in Kenya. And as the people who depend on this water for life move south, they inevitably enter into conflict with the people who already live there and claim the land and the water as their own. In the case of Sudan, especially in the region of Darfur, water security has played a major role in the conflict there that has actually resulted in genocide. All of these experiences show us that human flourishing is not possible without a stable source of water. And girls in some of the tribal communities in Africa, where there's been this great amount of conflict, their opportunities have been severely limited because young girls are the ones who have the task of going and traveling and walking each day to get the water from a far off source, and don't therefore have the opportunity to have education as young girls. So opportunities for all persons are lost when there is not a stable source of water. Water is not only life, it is the key to flourishing life. Now, we have some good news in our context, in our country. At least up until now, we have been extremely resourceful and extremely creative in making sure we have stable sources of water. Now, we know this doesn't mean we don't have conflicts. We have conflicts. Sometimes we have legal conflicts. And sometimes we don't respect the sovereignty of our indigenous siblings well enough when it comes to some of those legal conflicts over water. In the state of Oklahoma, we experienced that. I know that you've experienced that here in Arizona as well. The challenge that we are currently facing is whether our current sustainable relationship with water is something that's going to be able to go forward into the future. Increasing population alone puts a significant stress on our water resources, especially as we use more and more water for agriculture. We know this. If increasing water use owing to increasing population were the only challenge that we had when it comes to water, it would still be one of the most significant challenges we have ever faced in the history of human civilization. But unfortunately, the stress on water that comes from increasing population is being exacerbated by another incredibly complex challenge that we humans are primarily responsible for creating. And that is the challenge of, anyone want to guess it? Climate change. Yes. Coming from Oklahoma, I live in a state that is in a state of denial about climate change. Most likely because we are a state that is very much controlled by the fossil fuel industry, particularly the oil and gas industry, and it's difficult to get people to accept the reality of something when they are paid not to accept the reality of something. Unfortunately, even accepting the reality of climate change has become difficult because of what we in Oklahoma see as our economic dependence on fossil fuels. But unless we accept what is happening, unless we understand that it is our responsibility to do something about it, the challenges we are currently facing when it comes to water will seem minuscule as compared to what the future will bring from our current inaction. The challenge of addressing climate change is profoundly moral, a profoundly moral challenge for all of humanity, especially when it comes to our relationship with water. We have been extremely fortunate. We've had 10,000 years of relatively stable climate that has contributed to the growth and stability of human civilization. And in the midst of this stable climate, we have still found innumerable ways to be violent with each other, to be unjust to one another, and to harm the natural environment. Imagine how much worse the violence would be, the injustice would be, and the harm to our planet would be if we have a climate that is no longer stable, if we have an unlivable climate. Imagine how much more difficult it will be to maintain stable sources of water, the very key to life itself, in a world with a less stable climate, where the droughts are more intense and the flood events are more common. If we want to create more peace in this world, we cannot ignore climate change. For climate change will exacerbate the factors that lead people and countries into conflict. Climate change will fan the flames of war and violence as countries enter into more and more conflicts over water and resources for survival. Climate change will contribute to famine, disease, and disasters that will create a much more brutal and violent world as billions of persons struggle against one another for the means of survival. There will be no lasting peace without addressing climate change, without a stable climate. Many climate change deniers argue that our economy cannot afford to make the changes that are called for to address climate change. They argue that moving away from fossil fuels will damage our economy, create more poverty, and harm the poorest of the poor, who will no longer be lifted up by the global fossil fuel-driven economy. But the reality is that there can be no lasting economic progress without addressing climate change. An economy can only be sustainable over the long run if there is a stable and sustainable ecological community in which the economy can flourish. Economy and ecology have the same root word. Eco comes from oikos. Oikos means house. Economics are the laws of the house. Ecology is the study of the house. They're extremely closely interconnected. If we do not address climate change and our stable ecological community is damaged, there will be no economic flourishing. This will increase poverty and human suffering and will create even larger gaps between the rich and the poor in the world, leading to even greater injustice. There will be no lasting justice in the world without a stable climate. If we want fewer wars and less violence, if we want economic flourishing in our human community, and if we want a world in which more rather than fewer people can participate in this flourishing, then we must care about climate change. There can be no lasting peace, no lasting economic progress, no lasting justice without a stable climate. If we care about all of those things, we must care about climate change. Now, as we think about this, this challenge that we all face as a common humanity, I'd also like for us to think a little bit about what it is that churches like this one, like that church that we're in, what churches and other religious communities might be able to play in addressing the challenge of climate change and sustaining the life-giving water on our planet. And so as we think about what it is that churches and religious organizations might be able to do to work together on this great challenge and protect this life-giving water that's on our planet, I'm going to end my reflections with a parable. A parable that I think gets at the profound challenges that churches like ours are facing. So this parable begins in this way. There once was a mainline Christian denomination in the United States. Not necessarily the United Methodist Church, but okay, I was thinking about the United Methodist Church when I wrote this. There was once a mainline Christian denomination in the United States that was experiencing significant membership decline. Since its peak in membership in the 1950s and early 1960s, this denomination lost millions in total membership despite many intentional efforts to quell the decline. Untold numbers of church growth workshops and trainings and significant investment in consultants to right the course could not turn things around. Membership continued to plummet. The inability to reverse the decline was met with understandable concern as budgets and ministries were cut. As in all mainline denominations, there were many disagreements, including theological, some big theological disagreements, among clergy and laity. But nearly all were in agreement about one thing. They all agreed that something must be done to increase membership. Without more people in the pews, a once great denomination could become virtually non-existent within a couple of generations. Then, over a 10-year period, something of a miracle happened. After many years of study and strategizing about how to attract new members, the denomination finally figured it out, finally began to turn around. Finding the right combination of engaging worship and preaching, community involvement, and programs to help people deal with life's challenges, the denomination started to regain membership that it had been losing since the 1960s. This is a parable, by the way. I'm not saying what's actually happened. Other denominations took notice and learned from the revitalized denomination. Over time, this denomination led a revival of mainline Protestant churches in the United States. Membership boomed, new buildings were built, old buildings were renovated, budgets were increasing, new agencies and ministries were created, ministerial pension plans were in better shape than they had been for decades. In a relatively short period of time, mainline denominations were no longer looking back with nostalgia at the 1950s. A new day had dawned for mainline denominations in the United States, and the denomination that started the revival experienced growth and prosperity that it had never experienced before. Seminary attendance swelled as the church struggled to meet the demand for all the new ministers who were needed. Church growth experts lauded the 21st century as the century of renewal for Christianity in America. Wow. Two generations later, the membership of this denomination and all of the other denominations that had benefited from this significant revival saw their membership decimated by the massive die-off of humans caused by climate change and the climate change-induced economic and ecological collapse that the churches had done almost nothing to address. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com. www.isaiah.com.